Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:05, and that's Pacific Summer Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And when we think about things, then let's just break it down into two very simple topics. There is one is the supply of money, and the other is sentiment. And of course, they don't exist independently of one another, but rather one influences the other and vice versa. So, the Bank of China remains on a reflationary path. They've cut interest rates again today. They've loosened reserve requirements. And perhaps even more importantly, they have eliminated the divergence that has been in existence between the lending rate and the deposit rate for decades. That's contributed to the kind of environment that has been sort of casino-like, in that depositors weren't rewarded for saving in the bank at all, because the lending rate was in the order of 5%, 6%, and 7%, whereas the deposit rate was 1% and 2%. So, you know, then the incentive to go out and try and make money with a better return and move further out the risk profile was very compelling indeed. And this move is a further delivery upon the promises that were made to give the market more of a role in setting various rates within the economy. So that's really good news. But perhaps more important is that the Bank of China is easing monetary policy. Then you had Mario Draghi yesterday making very dovish comments, saying that they'll continue to do whatever is necessary. For some reason, people were doubting that the ECB would continue to do that, and I can't for the life of me think why. They embarked upon a process of quantitative easing and said that they were going to reflate the size of the ECB's balance sheet back to the 3 trillion euro that it was about 2.5 years ago. They're about halfway through that. So then why would they stop? Not least because they haven't achieved their primary goal, and the ECB's primary goal is to achieve an inflation rate of 2%, and they are a long way from that, and not least because commodity prices have fallen so much, and the way that they monitor inflation is slightly different to the way the Fed monitors inflation. But in any way you want to measure it, the expansion in economic activity in the Eurozone is coming in below par, but it was most certainly there. Well, that's obviously wasn't particularly good news for the euro, but again, it's an additional sign that monetary policy is not going to contract. And then you look at the Fed, and that's going to be the first central bank to raise interest rates, the first major central bank to raise interest rates. And that's important, not least because every other central bank is still got this extraordinary monetary policy. Think of what the Bank of Japan is doing, and what yesterday's moves and what the China's decisions have been with regard to monetary policy. And Japan is still expanding its balance sheet, the Bank of Japan's balance sheet, at a prodigious rate, and the yen weakened back below one, back above 120 in here over the last couple of days. It's at 120-140. That's exactly what the Japanese stock market needed. It was looking kind of ropey. It hasn't, the Nikkei hasn't had the same kind of rally that a number of other stock markets have had, and part of the reason for that was the relative strength of the yen. Well, the yen weakening again, that's great news for Japanese equities, and the second section index continues to lead there. Well, when you start to aggregate it all out, then central bank balance sheets are in the order of $15.6 trillion, and that's still a consistent uptrend. And looking at the news flow, we have to ask, what is the potential that it is going to contract in any meaningful way? And the answer has got to be, there is practically no chance of that. That if you look at what happened with the Bank of England when it ended its quantitative easing program, the size of the balance sheet didn't change one iota. It went just, it was entirely static after the end of quantitative easing. Unfortunately, the Bank of England has stopped producing that data. So the chart in the library hasn't updated since 2014, because the Bank of England simply doesn't publicize the data any longer. What we can conclude, though, is that if the Fed decides to go down the route of just not adding additional additional accommodation, that they're unlikely to withdraw or to start taking money out of the system. And that's important, because that's still a major it's by far the most important central bank, and its actions do have a meaningful effect. When they eventually raise rates, it will probably be looked on as a powerful vote of confidence in the economy to be able to endure higher interest rates, and that could be very positive for stock markets generally. But if we think and look at the markets as they are right now, then it really isn't a bad time to be thinking about the long term and to look at a number of 20 and 30 year charts. Well, for example, the Nasdaq got up to test its year 2000 peak in July and has experienced its largest pullback in at least 6 years from that peak. And over the last 4 weeks, it has rallied back and was up an additional 2.25% in here today to test those highs. And it's closing out the day at 4,618 on the future. And, you know, this is continuing to look like just a really impressive bounce, and we're right. We're I guess now let's just do a little bit of mental arithmetic, and we're about 60 points, 70 points actually, away from the peak in July for the Nasdaq 100, and it was up 120 today. So we could see the peak tested on Monday, but we have had a powerful rally, and a lot of the shorts that were initiated in late August have now been pressured, and we're coming back into the first area of potential resistance. And one has to ask, just was it overly surprising that you get a somewhat larger consolidation in the region of the bubble peak 15 years ago? And it wasn't overly surprising. And then the simple question, is it over now? Well, we won't know that until we've seen that the breakup of 4,500 holds. What we can certainly say is that there is a short-term overbought condition, and that the market has been led higher by some of its largest constituents, that really quite large moves today by Microsoft, Google, and Amazon are a clear delineation of who the leaders are in this market, and the fact that they are all benefiting from really starting to dominate cloud services and really outperforming companies like Oracle and EMC suggests that they're the real winners. But it also suggests that breadth is still pretty narrow in here, and it wouldn't be overly surprising if we see a range in consolidation, that we had a very big pullback, we've had a very impressive bounce back, and I wonder how many people would be the first to pay a new all-time high for the Nasdaq. And personally, I'd rather let somebody else do it at this level. So we might be in for some consolidation. But then the bigger question and the longer-term question is, how likely is the market to pull back in the same way that it did the last time it tested these levels 15 years ago? And valuations are considerably different now than they were then. One of the reasons that these major companies are breaking out to new highs is because they are well established and have got remarkable cash flow. That's totally different to where we were 15 years ago. And it helps to really emphasize the fact that this continues to look like a secular bull market for technology. That technology is the accelerating pace of technological development is still one of the primary reasons why one would consider that there is a secular bull market in evidence. It takes a long time for technology to reach commercial utility, and a number of the promises that were made in the bull market of the 1990s are coming true now, and that's helping to support valuations 15 years later. Despite the fact that we've had a quite a considerably larger pullback relative to anything that we've seen since 2009, then there is still the possibility that we're going to get some additional ranging. But as David has been pointing out since he came back from vacation, that this is entering now a seasonally more bullish time of the year. So any consolidation that might happen could potentially be above the 200-day moving average. And we would need to see a clear downward dynamic, and in the order on the downside of the upper dynamic that we saw this week, to really indicate that anything other than temporary resistance is being encountered in this area. And with that said, there's no evidence yet that a resistance has been encountered at all. To the extent that the NASDAQ is leading, the Russell 2000 has been lagging. And even there, what we saw today was an advance of about 1%, and that index has been largely range-bound for the last 18 months. It's pushing back up towards the psychological 1200 level, and that was an area of support for much, of resistance for much of 2014. And it really will need to push above it to really indicate that demand is back in the driver's seat. And of course, the smaller cap sector is more sensitive to interest rates, and there has been a lot of concern about just how well they're going to cater to interest rates eventually rising. And the US is perhaps the most relevant example when we look at Europe, because the USA is now coming towards the end of its quantitative easing. And we may see interest rates rising at the end of this year or the beginning of next year. But perhaps more important is that it represents a template for what we can expect from Europe, because we're looking at the NASDAQ, which had a phenomenal bubble peak in 2000, and it was the epicenter of risk then, and it had a phenomenal crash, and it's now back at its peak. But if you look at, for example, the Eurostoxx index, and I'll post the 20-year chart in here today, that hit an important peak in 2000. It hit an important, it tested that peak in 2007-2008, and we're a little more than halfway back up towards those peaks. And the ECB is about halfway through its quantitative easing program, and there's no reason to believe that the ECB will not engage in additional quantitative easing if they deem it necessary. And it will be necessary unless the Eurozone economy is generating inflation of about 2% a year. That is their only mandate. They've taken on a lot of responsibilities over the last 5 or 6 years, but their primary and their stated mandate is to achieve an inflation target. Well, European equities were up. The DAX was up by almost 3% today. The CAC was up 2.5%. The FTSE up 1%. They've pulled back considerably more than, for example, the S&P 500. And they totally unwound the boost that they got in nominal terms from the devaluation of the euro earlier this year. Well, the euro is at 110.10. At the close today, and it was at it was testing the 114 area at the beginning of the week, so and certainly last week. So what is now there was an argument whether the range in consolidation that has seen a progression of high reaction lows for the euro over the last 6 months was a low of a medium term or even potentially long term significance. And that progression of higher reaction lows has now been broken with the large downward dynamic that we saw this week. It then raises the potential that we're going to go right down and test the low. And And these are very large moves in currency markets, and it's quite unusual. You don't normally see these kinds of large moves in currency markets, but it is phenomenally bullish for Eurozone equities. Germany in particular, the DAX being a total return index, its performance is slightly flattered. But Germany doesn't particularly need this weak currency, but it's certainly going to benefit, or its export sector is going to benefit from it. And certainly the periphery of Europe needs a weak currency, and they will benefit from their exports becoming more competitive, not least against the US dollar. And we saw how the European equities rallied earlier this year with the devaluation of the euro. It's entirely open to question whether the Fed or the Treasury, probably more likely the Treasury, in the US is going to be happy with a euro that weakens beyond 105. But it's quite clear that the Europeans don't want to see the euro higher than 115. So at the minimum, we're in a range. We're certainly moving towards the lower side of that range right now. And the impetus has now returned to euro bears. And that's largely positive for European equities, which continue to trade at a discount to their U.S. counterparts. But more importantly is that European equities are potentially following the path of U.S. equities, but with a 3 or 4 year lag. That the pullback that we saw in European equities over the last 6 months is probably more akin to what the S&P or the NASDAQ encountered in 2011. And that would suggest then that provided the ECB remains on a quantitative easing footing and is angling towards an additionally weak euro, then that's likely to be very positive for European equities. In just the same way that the Bank of Japan's largesse has been very bullish for Japanese equities. Then, if you look at China, we had a phenomenal bull run early in the year, and we've had a phenomenal crash subsequently, and now a reversion to the mean has largely been completed. And this is still a market that is certainly not expensive, and particularly when you look at Hong Kong, where the Hang Seng or the H shares are trading at single-digit multiples and have yields in the order of 3 and 4%. And that brings us back to something that's also quite similar to what we had in 2011, and that is that the kinds of shares that are starting to garner interest are those that pay reasonable dividends. And it's rather interesting that McDonald's has been ranging for 3 years and just broke out. And prior to its bull run that ended in 2012, it had yielded 3.5%, and that yield had contracted to about 2.5%. And over the last 3 years, that yield has increased again out to about 3.5%, and now it's become attractive to yield-hungry investors once more. And it would be something if that was an isolated incident, but we're seeing commonality, that it is the big consumer services and restaurant companies and consumer discretionary companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer that are starting to break out. And that's completing ranges. Well, for McDonald's, it was 3 years. For Coca-Cola, it's not quite there yet, but it's also in the order of about 3 years, and Coca-Cola's back yielding over 3%. Pepsi has been ranging for most of the year and is now looking like it's going to break out. And, these are shares that have largely been absent. When one looks at the types of companies that are breaking out to new highs, then you're either presented with the high technology shares that have a competitive advantage and are really pressing home that advantage in the likes of Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. But then, by and large, their defensive shares that are breaking out to new highs are those that have been trending higher and are just now accelerating higher. And Nike or Starbucks, you know, is now more overextended relative to the trend mean than it was before the pullback in August. So, you know, those are where there is a certain amount of risk, or Activision Blizzard would be another example. But when you start to look at the other side of the equation, then how many shares are making new lows? And it's a smaller number of shares that are making new lows. In other words, the vast majority of shares are trading below their highs and above their lows and have been making new one-month highs. And that would suggest that the majority of shares are sort of there, thereabouts with the index, that the beta has narrowed quite considerably, and that's rather interesting. And I haven't seen anything specifically like that in quite some time, and it suggests that that's not particularly a bad condition for the market, and it suggests that as we still the most likely scenario is that we get some additional ranging, but that. It's never been our contention that the secular bull market was over, but rather that we've had a somewhat larger correction, and we were due a larger correction, and that we could be potentially ranging for a while longer. And for the S&P, it's already been ranging for a year. And the likelihood of central banks withdrawing the liquidity that has helped fuel this market is becoming progressively more distant. Well, with stock markets continuing to do this well, then bonds have been a bit weaker this week. And the 30-year was down an additional point in here today, and the 10-year yield is continuing to push up. There's a progression of higher reaction lows on the 10-year yield, and that's consistent with a distribution in yield. It suggests that investors see better opportunities elsewhere. The spread that we've seen in bonds had expanded and has contracted a bit over the last couple of weeks as stock markets have recovered, but that shock has probably been sufficiently large for people to be a little bit more reticent. And it has certainly been more difficult for a number of companies to source debt at ultra low rates, and the cost of borrowing is likely to increase for corporations as the prospect of interest rates beginning to rise sometime next year becomes progressively more realistic. That's unlikely to result in a big problem in terms of refinancing for corporations in the broad market. There's been an incredible amount of debt taken out over the last 6 years, and the majority of that doesn't come to maturity for another few years. So that's a medium-term consideration, that there is a waterfall of bonds that will be maturing from about 2018, 19, and 20 that we simply do not have this year. There's a small number need to be refinanced next year. And that means then that the outlook for the bond markets isn't as bullish as it was, but neither are we in a disastrous environment, and not least because inflation, as central banks measure it, is not really apparent, that the commodities have pulled back enough, that economic activity is not robust enough, and that wage growth has not yet broken out. Then those are the kinds of things that would move the needle for central banks. But commodities have pulled back to such an extent that they're in all likelihood a lot closer to a meaningful low than they have been. And with the dollar now strengthening up, then the potential for some of those short-term overbought conditions in the commodity markets to be unwound is looking progressively more likely. And when you look at, for example, platinum, which rallied by over $100 in the space of 2 weeks and pushed back above 1,000. And it was at 1021 or 1,021 in here today. The potential for some consolidation is looking more likely than not. Or, for example, sugar, which has been in a reasonably tight consolidation, having broken back above the 200-day moving average over the last month. Well, now we're going to see whether it can hold that breakout. And that's the case for even gold, you know, which was relatively inert in here today. But can they break their progressions of lower rally highs? There's been an incredible amount of stress, and the amount of supply that's still in the market or coming onto the market is likely to deteriorate as investment in additional new mines is just withdrawn. But they probably need a demand stimulus to pick up, and I wouldn't rule that out. The extent to which the dollar rallies, not so much against the euro, the dollar euro is much more of a weak euro than a strong dollar, a strong dollar story, and you can see that when you look at the dollar against a whole basket of currencies. You know, for example, against the Aussie dollar, it's relatively unchanged in here today, and the yen and the euro are both fundamentally weak currencies. But what happens with the US dollar and emerging markets is going to be very telling. I absolutely abhor the terminology emerging markets, because it lumps a whole basket of countries in Latin America and Asia and Africa together that often bear absolutely no relation to one another. But unfortunately, that is not how international investors tend to view the sector. And there's certainly been a high degree of commonality right across it. So we saw that, for example, the Brazilian real, the Indonesian rupiah, the South African rand had become really extremely overextended relative to their trend means and had accelerated lower. And that oversold condition has now been unwound. And the recent resurgence in the dollar is raising the potential that those lows will be retested. And the real test then of whether demand has returned to dominance and whether these currencies have found support beyond the short term will be in their success in finding support above their respective lows. This is something that international investors are going to be watching, because over the decade from 2002 onwards, international investors were able to invest in Asia or invest in Latin America, and they got currency market, capital market, and interest rates all in their favor. That hasn't been the case over the last 18 months, as a number of currencies have trended lower. And they've pulled back so much that you've had currencies that have halved in value. Well, that just means that the competitiveness of that economy has doubled in the same period of time. And that's very meaningful. That means that the potential for economic growth in manufacturing, in the services sector, is very powerful. And international investors will be looking for evidence that those currencies can find support at progressively higher levels, that they have bottomed, that interest rates have risen enough to encourage buyers of those currencies back in. And if that is the case, then we could get emerging markets starting to lead on the way back out of what has been a very large corrective phase. So it wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility that we start to see economic growth surprises coming through next year. And not least because very energy-intensive economies are going to benefit enormously from low energy prices. That oil, West Texas is currently at 44.63, Brent is at 47, just under $48. And how likely is it that we're going to see $100 oil anytime soon? I would suggest really quite unlikely. And that's also very positive for any economy that's a major consumer of energy, and that there's a lot of them. So it wouldn't be at all surprising that we see growth starting to surprise on the upside. And if growth surprises on the upside, that will then start to kick in with a demand-driven equilibrium returning to the commodity markets. And that would eliminate a lot of the deflationary fears that I would prefer to characterize as disinflationary fears that have really been plaguing the market over the last 2 months. So when we start to look out a little bit and start to look past what has been concerning markets, then there is a significant reason to be optimistic. And, the hump that investors have to get over is in the eventual normalization of interest rates. But the other way to think about it is that central banks aren't going to normalize interest rates until they have absolute confidence that all of their good work isn't going to be undone by raising interest rates. So then we're either going to be in an environment where the market continues to be flooded with liquidity or has recovered to such an extent that it no longer needs it. And in either case, it's bullish for asset prices. There wouldn't be a market unless there was indecision or there was a violent opposition to that kind of perspective, which contributes to medium-term corrections along the way. And we're certainly in coming potentially towards the end of one of those, or at least seeing the low. And then the only question is, how long does it take before the medium-term uptrends can be reasserted? But considering that we've had the largest pullback in a number of years, then the question would be, is this going to turn into a lengthier consolidation where we range for somewhat longer, or is this going to be an acceleration? And then is there going to be a bubble in valuations? Well, valuations have improved over the last few months with this big pullback. And certainly valuations have improved for the kinds of shares that have been ranging for a period of time. We do not have bubble valuations. And even in the biotechnology sector, which had run, probably too far ahead and has subsequently underperformed, even there, we don't have the same kind of bubble valuations that we would have had 15 years ago. But then the question is, are we going to get to a point where there is going to be bubble valuations? And considering that monetary policy is as easy as it is, then there is potential that that could be how markets eventually do hit medium-term peaks. Medium-term meaning beyond 6 months, but that we get into a situation where some sector becomes horribly overvalued. And I think we're going to find out, because when we think about this and go back and just look at how we address these questions from the perspective of the chart seminar and the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets, well, we're well past a depression. We're certainly in acceptance that this is a liquidity-fueled environment. And then the question is, are we going to get into euphoria? Well, we're at that point. We're sort of between the second and the third psychological perception stages. And how this range is eventually resolved is going to give us a pretty good indication of how that is likely to happen. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.